This will be a talk mostly to elucidate some of the things that we've learned in the last few years about the smaller scale magnetic elements on the sun. So I won't be talking so much about sunspots and the larger magnetism and the cyclic sort of things that you heard about this morning, but I will be discussing, emphasizing in fact, in talking about current observations, how we measure photospheric flow field and magnetic field characteristics and what that means. And if I have some time, I can talk a little bit at the end about the Solar Bee mission. And I don't have anything on SDO right now, so that's a false bullet point. But anyway, as a quick review, I'm talking about the solar photosphere. And these are some of the numbers that have sort of stabilized. 5770 Kelvin for the blackbody peak. The pressure is 6.159 per centimeter squared. The spectral alignments, these are of interest when you start talking about velocities of how things are moving around in the photosphere. The thermal width is about 1.4 kilometers per second. Microturbulence is generally quoted to be around 1 kilometer a second, and the macroturbulent parameter is anywhere from 1.6 in the vertical to about 3 kilometers per second horizontal. So the line width typically, if you quadrature these, ends up to be about 2.5 to 3 kilometers a second. The speed of sound is 7.4 kilometers per second nominally, and the opacity is dominated by the H-minus ion in the photosphere. A quick review of some of the high-resolution observations that we've made in the past of the photosphere and the magnetism therein. This was taken at the Swedish Vacuum Solar Telescope on La Palma in 1997. It was phase diversity enhanced, corrected for wavefront errors by Mats Loftel. What you're looking at is a section of the sun about 30 by 40 megameters in size. These are, of course, the solar granules. These are G-band bright points delineating sites of high concentrated magnetic field in the kilogauss range. You can see micropores in here as well. This was a very large pore that never developed a penumbra. It was back in 97 when we were coming up out of the minimum, so it was an interesting structure all in itself. And I'll quickly show you a movie of this, using this software, which is really nice. Plus key. This is about 5 hours of data. And again, phase diversity corrected for seeing and telescopic blurring. But there are still some inconsistencies in the seeing that you can see. It's pointing a little slowly. But generally, what is ubiquitous about small-scale magnetism on this kilogauss range is that it exists within the... Oh, there it goes. It's loaded the RAM. It exists within the intergranular lanes. It's continually shredded, moved about, merged, and basically dominated by the photospheric flow field. But it holds patterns that are fairly steady as well. You can see here there's sort of a ring of flux that, while individual elements may be moving around quite a bit, there seems to be a divergence center there composed of several granules. This might be called something like a mesogranule here, a large mesogranule, in terms of convective flow. You can also see that in the pore, another common feature of pore flows is that we see flows into the pore. When you have a fully developed mature sunspot whose umbra might not be much larger than this, but who's developed a penumbra, you'll see outflows from the penumbra. So it's interesting that when you don't have a penumbra, you can see maybe underneath, you can see into these sort of inward flows. So this is sort of a typical look at the photosphere and small-scale magnetism up to sort of meso or large-scale magnetism with its pore flows. And this is about including Sac Peak and some of the work done by the DOT. This is about the highest resolution movie that we can make right now. It's getting down to the scale of about 150 to 200 kilometers. Some of these smaller bright points that you see are on that scale. And the speeds I'll talk a little bit about later. We've done measurements of those as well. So back to the PowerPoint. And, let's review some of the flow field measurement techniques that we use to actually extract physical data out of movies such as that. There are, of course, Doppler velocity measurements. These are some of the oldest measurements of flow fields around. I won't talk much about those. Those are typically spectral methods, or you can use filters such as the MDI instrument. Precisions nowadays are down to 20 meters a second. MDI has a spatial resolution, however, that's fairly large if you want to talk about small-scale flows. I will talk more about local correlation tracking and object tracking. Local correlation tracking is an image pattern analysis method which allows you to derive the horizontal flow field, in this case of the photosphere, by looking at the patterns of intensity in each image. I will emphasize several times during this talk that the results depend on resolution, spatial resolution, and temporal resolution, and also of the grid size you use to analyze your image relative to the structures in the image. Precisions now are down to about 100 meters per second at the 200 kilometer resolutions that we're achieving with some of the highest resolution ground-based images. Then I'll go ahead and talk about object tracking, which is a little bit different. Here you're not doing sort of a global pattern analysis, but you're actually segmenting the images into specific objects that you want to track and making measurements of their motions, deriving parameters that way. It's a relatively simple technique because you're simply measuring a centroid, for instance, from frame to frame. However, it depends greatly on the success of your image segmentation method, how well you can reproduce the object from frame to frame. The precision, however, in good segmentations has gotten down to something on the order of 100 meters per second. So it's comparable to local correlation tracking in its precision. It's a little harder to do because each object is a little bit different. To review LCT measurement techniques, there's sort of three basic techniques that are used commonly today. There's a minimum cross-correlation coefficient and minimum absolute difference methods. Both of those rely on taking a reference image, breaking it up into a reference grid, taking a comparison image, breaking it up into subtiles, which you then basically shift around and minimize metric here. Both of these methods have require really Gaussian apodization of the intensity on the tile in order to get a good minima to work with. And this is the parameter that the full width at half maximum of the apodization, we find is a key parameter in, as I will show, the final results of any local correlation tracking. So obviously the smaller your tiles, the smaller motions you can pick up. However, you get more noise. And thirdly, there is the optical flow method, which is relatively new. That's more of a matrix, global matrix minimization method that Neil Hurlburt sort of published in relation to solar physics in 97, but it's been around for a while in image analysis techniques. Here I'll show one of the common things you can do once you've got local correlation tracking measurements, namely displacements of subtiles from image to image. You can then measure velocities of these tiles and get a sort of a horizontal flow field in your movie. What we've done with those flow fields to visualize them is then place passive scalars in the form of corks, as we call them, on top of the flow field and then let it go and watch where the corks go as they follow the derived local correlation tracking flow. And there's the person. What you can see here is about 3 hours and 10 minutes of evolution in a G-band movie. There's a large sunspot here, so you can see some flow out here, and you'll notice that on the cadence of this is 23 seconds between frames, so we have very good temporal resolution of the granular motions. What you can see is, I played again, is that the corks are doing what you expect. They're moving out of the way of the intensity, local intensity maxima, which derive the velocity in most cases. More interesting, perhaps, is the fact that in plage regions like this, this is a region of magnetic, high magnetic element concentration, you can see that there's very little dispersal of the corks. They seem to congregate on smaller sort of granular or several granular scales here as well. Whereas outside of these active regions, the corks are very quickly cleared out into dominant sink patterns in the flow. This has been known for quite some time, that without constant refreshing of corks in this area, within several hours, it's just completely empty. There's a poster up by John Lawrence, Anna Christina Katavid, and myself, and I think Alexander, is he on there as well? He's on there as well. There's a poster that's showing some of this data and doing statistical analyses on the cell sizes of the various cork patterns you see and relating those to the cell sizes that we see in granulation and also mesogranulation. I should mention that this is one of the key ways of seeing mesogranulation. If you take any of these cork movies, within about a half an hour of placing corks on them, they form mesogranular cells, which are quite noticeable. And if you refresh the corks, they will continue to sort of outline these sort of 6 to 8 to 10 arc seconds. No, they're larger than that. They're sort of 6 to 10 granules, or sort of cells on that size are very clearly seen in cork flow. So that's one of the advantages. In this case, they are, I believe, about a quarter of the size of granule, or a fifth. Oh, is that what? Oh, okay, yeah, there it is. Yeah.
And so presumably your velocity is on a grid with that spacing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet these things seem to find their way very precisely into the granular length.
Yeah, well, it's an interpolated velocity field. Yeah. You linearly interpolate where you don't have a grid point, and yeah. It accurately reproduces what we see with magnetic elements as well. They're swept into the intergranular lanes and they kind of stay there.
I'm wondering how much it depends on the initial placement of the tiles. I mean, suppose that you put a random jiggle into the positions of the tiles to start with.
The tiles or the corks?
Excuse me, the corks.
Yeah.
And had a slightly different cork pattern for initial conditions. You always end up with
yeah, I've done that, and you always, it takes them maybe longer to achieve their equilibrium positions, but I've done things like put square grids, circle grids, patches and things, and the basic behavior is the same. In a quiet region, again, they'll always find these sort of strong sinks in the flow field. In an active region or an active network region, they'll sort of find these mesogranular or small mesogranular scale locations where the flow, the horizontal flow is actually very subdued there. The back reaction, the field upon the flow is strong. So we don't measure local correlation tracking has very low signal to noise in these areas, so you don't get a lot of signal there, and that's perhaps one of the reasons the corks collect there. On the other hand, the magnetic field is also collected there, so it seems to replicate the solar behavior pretty well.
And you're going to show us that this matched the bite point? The
speed measurements, yeah. I mean, here you can see that what it's doing is it's finding the little bright points. The reason you don't see too many little bright points is because they're all covered by quarks.
Okay.
This is a typical speed measurement from local correlation tracking. What we can do now is do statistical analyses on the individual velocity vectors we get out of it, and we find typically these Maxwellian or Rayleigh distributions, as the statisticians like to call them. So this is showing two fields of view within a data set. One in which it's fairly quiet sun with no G-band bright points or magnetic signal in evidence, and the other in an active network field on the edge of a supergranule. Or do I have that backwards? Network, yeah. Quiet sun network. And you can see that in the quiet sun, it's a higher average. It's got a higher it's got a higher tail. So in general, the flow speed suppression due to the magnetic element network is quite clear when you do the statistics. And this is taking those statistics and basically making them spatial images. This is a horizontal speed map. What you're seeing is a 30 by 30 arc second field of view encompassing a supergranular boundary with the black outline showing the location of magnetic elements or previous where there are magnetic elements anywhere in that data set. This covers about an hour's worth of time. It's averaged over an hour. And so you can see that where there are magnetic elements, the horizontal speed is again very low. Where there are not, you get these sort of large scale, high speed, in this case, convergence. If you look at the quiet sun, and you can also see that the cell size here is relatively randomly scattered. If you look at the quiet sun, it's much more even. And this shows the effect of varying the window full width at half maximum. As I mentioned earlier, it depends, local correlation tracking results depend on your full width at half maximum apodization, or essentially you can think of it as the tile size. For a larger tile size, you measure a lower speed, and as you decrease the tile size, you measure a higher speed. And it fits fairly well onto this sort of inverse root mean square distribution. If you extrapolate that down to a zero tile size, in this case, we end up with something on the order of 1,800 meters per second for typical flow speeds in the quiet sun. Okay, object tracking. The goal is the same. The goal is to sort of measure the horizontal speed in the photosphere. But in this case, we're selecting individual objects and using them as tracers from frame to frame, and not relying on any sort of cross-correlation or minimization of a metric. This, what I'm showing here, is that same 30 arc second square area that you saw on the speed map. The cyan objects are G-band bright points, which have been segmented from the image using a technique that I developed in my thesis work. The dark blue shows where there have been in the past these G-band bright points. And this is two frames, one taken 392 seconds into the data set, and one taken at the end of the data set, 4,000 seconds later. And you can see that the distribution of bright points isn't too much different in the two. The number of bright points isn't very different. But the bright points over that time have covered a certain amount of area. So we can use this sort of tracking and tracing to do diffusive measurements on them. One of the interesting things that we found in this data set is if you look here at the beginning of the data set, you can see a ring of bright points here and here. If you look at the end of the data set, you can pretty much see the same two rings. They seem, and this is a common feature I've seen in several data sets now, you can find these rings of flux, which sort of encompass areas on the order of 3 to 4 granules, sometimes only 2 granules, that are stable for sometimes hours. Individual bright points will be moving around like crazy, merging, splitting, and being bumped around, but they won't intrude into these sort of high divergence. If you look here in the G-band movie, you'll see constantly diverging granule cells just popping up constantly. So these rings of flux are very stable, typically, in networks. And this is just taking the same histogram approach that I showed you with local correlation tracking, but with doing it with object tracking. And in fact, I've overlaid some local correlation tracking results. This is LCT from a network region, the magnetic network region that is shown in the previous slide. This is the object tracking for those G-band bright points I showed segmented. These are the quiet sun results. And this is the quiet sun showing the higher speed again. The clear difference, though, in terms of the LCT is, although we get about the same mean velocity, namely about 1.5 kilometers a second, there's a much higher speed tail that we measure. And I don't know if I'd trust too much farther beyond about 3 kilometers a second, but between 2 and 3, there's a fairly good signal here, and I do believe that's real. That's a real signal. In other words, the LCT measurements are dropping off relatively rapidly there. You don't find too much shifting of the tiles at that speed. But these magnetic elements do appear to be getting bumped at speeds at least 2,000 kilometers a second sometimes. So that's one of the advantages of object tracking. You're obviously getting essentially a smaller spatial resolution. Okay, as a summary, the techniques for measuring horizontal and vertical flow fields in the photosphere are now considered mature. Major local correlation tracking assumption that you have to be aware of is that we are tracking image intensity as a passive scalar. We don't track density or anything physically related to the flow per se. We track the brightness fluctuations, and that you can get into debates as to whether that's really horizontal velocity or temperature flows or something like that. But that's all we can do with these. That's the best we can do with what we have in terms of intensity observations. And the final warning, Doppler, LCT, and object tracking are all spatial temporal resolution and, in a sense, algorithm dependent. So if somebody says that the flow speed in their photospheric measurements is X, you have to immediately say at what resolution and what was your temporal cadence. George Simon and several other authors did a comparison of local correlation tracking algorithms applied to the exact same MDI white light data set. And the speed maps are interesting. They show definite differences, even though they're in that case exactly the same spatial resolution of the instrument and temporal resolution. And I don't know about the tile sizes. I think they tried to keep them relatively the same, and they still ended up with significantly different cell positions. So it's a.
In addition to the resolution, do you see with object tracking dependence on the size of the object?
You can run into things because typically what you're doing there is relying on centroiding the object. And if you have a large extended object and you're just tracking the centroid, that might not move very much, whereas the object itself can be moving and changing quite a bit. And then you get into things like merging and how you handle that. So, yeah, the point being that smaller sort of more isolated objects are better, if you can.
You're not attributing actual physical difference in the speed that small objects move. Well, you're saying technically it's just harder to be precise about the motion of a large amorphous object.
Mm-hmm.
So the new quantum resolution is 200 kilometers, especially the 20-second cadence. It gives me 10 kilometers per second. Meanwhile, the Bose methods, LST and objects achieve 100 meters per second, factor of 100 better than stupid estimate. So, and it involves some errors. It's a great achievement of Bose methods, but it also includes some cracks.
Yeah, I think that the precision, the maximum precision numbers I was quoting weren't for this 200 kilometer 20 second data set. They're for other data sets where you have much higher cadence, things like that. So that's...
It's not 20 seconds.
No. Yeah, everybody has different cadences, and so those numbers are sort of the best we've done in these methods, in any using the best data sets for those methods. Yeah, zero. I'm not sure. Well, we can talk about that offline, but it's a complicated issue. With
tracking the strong fields, you know, the whole world, the whole hierarchy of weak fields, I don't think there's any point in the sun where there is a strong field.
Yeah, I would probably agree with that. And ideally, we'd like to have magnetograms, right, with this kind of spatial and temporal resolution and track those. But nobody can make a magnetogram at 200 kilometers resolution. It just can't be done.
No, but you can see the weak fields.
You can see the weak fields, but then you have to really worry about your spatial resolution. Yeah. Yeah. But then you have to wonder about whether you're seeing a filling factor effect and there's really a lot of little elements below that, or you'd like to be semi-resolved, and I think... Yeah, okay, well, we can talk about that after. Speaking of... In the case of that data set I showed you, which is an hour, there were...
3 hours?
The object tracking results I'm showing here were done on an hour-long data set, and there were many bright points which lasted that period of time. If you define lasting as including merging, so there's, you can take a bright point and track it as an element for the entire data set, if you include the fact that it sometimes merges with other things and continues to go, and or fragments, you can take a fragment, but the merging is easier to track. So up to hours, I would say. Okay, I'll briefly review some of the magnetic field measurements we've done in the photosphere and how we do it more. A lot of my work recently has been trying to understand exactly how to interpret filter magnetograms and vector magnetograms in relation to the Solar Bee instrument, which will fly one of each. And so a quick review of sort of the large scale or the various scales of magnetic field on the sun would show that sunspots, being the largest, have these diameters on the order of 30,000 kilometers. Lifetimes from days to weeks, field strengths from 2,000 to 3,000 Gauss, down through pores, which are, as I showed you earlier, sort of sunspots without penumbra, although typically they're much smaller than sunspots, on the order of 10,000 kilometers or less. Magnetic network elements, which is what I was talking about earlier in terms of object tracking, these typically have diameters of less than 200 kilometers. Their lifetimes, I've listed minutes here, but that could include 60 to 90, something like that. Field strength, we believe, is anywhere in the range from 500 to 1500 Gauss, probably more towards the kilogauss range. And then finally, there's this turbulent granular field, which has been, as Hal mentioned, seen for quite some time, but maybe not measured and understood as well as we'd like. Here, the lifetime isn't to me, is not in the literature. It's not easy to nail that down. There have been some field strength measurements recently in the IR by people like Rimmela and Haoxing Lin, showing a range between sort of 1 to 10 Gauss on that order. And from now on, I'll focus on magnetic network elements, sort of what I was showing you before, and how we measure them in terms of their magnetic field. So in terms of magnetic field measurement techniques, this is a quick review. The Zeeman effect is sort of, I've broken it down into sort of two types of measurements: spectrometer-based instruments, such as these Van-Stokes polarimeter at SACPEAK, the Kitt Peak magnetograph, or the MSU near IR magnetograph, or the imaging filter-based instruments, such as MDI on SOHO, the SUP magnetogram at La Palma, the video filter magnetograph at Big Bear, Zurich imaging polarimeter at SACPEAK. And there's some very distinct differences in the way these two types of instruments achieve their measurements. There is also an increasing interest in looking at Hanley effect measurements of weak magnetic fields in the sun. This is essentially it's very different than the Zeeman effect. It's essentially looking at the depolarization due to scattering of linear polarization coming through these sort of weak magnetic field areas. I won't talk about that. I don't know much about it, but it is potentially very useful for measuring these turbulent fields and granulation, and you will be seeing more of that in the coming years, I'm sure. So I'll focus on Zeeman effect measurements in the visible spectrum in particular. I don't know too much about the IR. Here is an example of a filter magnetograph taken with the SUP filter magnetograph at the SVST in La Palma. This is in the iron line, 6302, and it's a Stokes V magnetogram. It's one of the best that we achieved in 1998 anyway. It's got resolution down to about 250 kilometers, about 0.3 arc seconds, and that's specifically, if you look in here, you can see these very small, localized, little magnetic elements. And I've, simultaneous with this, I've got G-band and K-line, and I've done a study relating the two. But for now, I'd just like to show that this is sort of a typical filter magnetograph. You can see that filter magnetographs have the advantage, because they're not spectrometers, they're scanning it, that they can achieve instantaneous images with fairly high spatial resolution. But you can also see some really interesting effects here in the umbra. In particular, this is Zeeman saturation. This is a very strong field, but it's not registering as much. It's not registering here because of the Zeeman saturation effect, as I'll explain later. So these things take some real care in interpretation. Just to briefly review the Zeeman effect, in this case, if we look at a normal, what we call the normal Zeeman effect, which is actually relatively rare, you split the line into three different components, one redshifted and one blue-shifted, and the central component, the splitting here is given as shown earlier as a lambda-square dependence. This is the Landé effect, Landé factor, and that's the magnetic field strength. Okay. In sunspots with magnetic fields up to 3,000 Gauss, the splitting of an iron line, for instance, is actually larger than the Doppler broadening of the line. You can directly observe and measure the splitting of the line. John Brule showed us some measurements earlier of direct splitting measurements on stellar spectra. So if you can observe the direct splitting of the line, you've got it. You can directly measure the field strength through the splitting magnitude. Unfortunately, for small-scale magnetic elements and most of the elements that we look at in the sun, the Zeeman splitting width is less than the Doppler width, or comparable to, and therefore you don't resolve the splitting of the line. You have to use polarimetry in order to infer field strength. So I say here, one of the good news things is that the splitting is proportional to lambda squared, so that in the IR, we are beginning to get direct measurements of line splitting in small-scale fields. Lin and Rimmela in 1999 did that with quiet granulation and found field in quiet granulation looking at the splitting. The bad news about that is that IR detectors are still a relatively new technology. They're limited to currently larger pixel sizes than we'd like, and perhaps lower formats. So one of the solution that has been taken for years now is to look at the polarization of the three splitting components and use polarimetry. A quick review of that would show that if you look along, if this is the magnetic field vector here in a typical Zeeman triplet, the blue shifted component is, say, right circularly polarized. The pi component, the unshifted component, is linearly polarized parallel to the field. And the red shifted sigma component is left circularly polarized. So by using polarization state of the light beam, you can back out the essentially the components of the field. And this again is a review of the Stokes IQ, U, and V. They are related to intensities of the electric field vectors. We do a time average, of course, and it's also non-monochromatic. The basic principle being that by measuring the Stokes vector components, you can invert the radiative transfer to infer B. And that's a key statement there. We are no longer directly measuring B. We are inferring B through inversion techniques at best. And in the case of not measuring the full Stokes vector, you end up inferring much less, really. I'll skip this. This is a review of the radiative transfer, just showing that basically you want this is your observer, and these are some of the key angles. What you end up saying in most polarimetry is you end up measuring the field along the line of sight. So you'll see B cosine psi throughout this the remainder of this presentation. In particular, the simplest solution to the polarimetry, the polarized radiative transfer solution that we can look at is a longitudinal field so that the psi angle becomes zero. And the two absorption coefficients then the only ones surviving are the intensity and the Stokes V absorption coefficient. And the Stokes V absorption coefficient is simply red minus blue over 2. So by taking essentially the difference in circular polarization, as shown here, the difference in two intensity images, one right circularly polarized and left circularly polarized, say, you can derive Stokes V as a polarimetric measurement. What? Oh, yeah, sorry. Sorry, yeah, that should be minus. And you can show that, you can see that this is essentially approximated as di0 d lambda times delta lambda. If you consider that this is the slope of the line in the wing, for instance, then you've got the Stokes V directly proportional to the splitting of the line again, and therefore you have V is proportional to B cosine psi. So that is the basic idea. These are some profiles calculated with the Milne-Eddington solution of the UNO equation showing Stokes I, Stokes V, the anti-symmetric profiles, and Stokes Q. This is now not showing a longitudinal field. This, in order to get a Q signal, you have to be looking off the field, so this is a 45-degree line of sight. So by using these fields now, we are able to infer the magnetic field, the ideal algorithm being to measure the profile of I, Q, U, and V, and iterate the radiative transfer solution with B, psi, and chi as your parameters, and you get the inferred magnetic field vector. This is essentially what the advanced Stokes polarimeter does. And whoops, this is slow. These are some measurements taken actually by the La Palma Stokes polarimeter, an ASP derivative, just showing the iron 6302 lines. These are terrestrial lines, and the Q, U, and V signals they infer by looking, in this case, at quiet sun. Okay, so I need to hurry up a little bit, and I'll just remind people that the big problem with any of the magnetic measurements we make on the sun these days is that the solar structure, the structure of the magnetic field is intermittent. Therefore, any pixel is integrating over any non-magnetic and magnetic regions. So the best we can do in this case is to define a filling factor and incorporate that as a parameter in the inversion, so that B, psi, chi, and F, the filling factor, are now results of an inversion. Yes. So, I'd like to show you what you can do to make a much faster magnetogram than the one I showed you before, is rather than try to derive Stokes profile measurements in a spectrometer, you simply take a filter, you do intensity in the right circular polarization and left circular polarization, and the difference here is then essentially the magnetogram image that you see. You can use the slope and the direct splitting proportional to B, or you can also do a line center centroiding measurement technique in order to derive the magnetic field that way. One more thing to keep in mind about magnetograms that you see typically made through filters is that there is a linear regime in which these can be fairly well calibrated. This is showing magnetic field strength in Gauss, again the UNO solutions, and the peak Stokes V over I, which is typically what a filter magnetogram is showing you. And as you can see, there is a regime here up to about, in this case, this is a modeled response of the soup filter, about 700 to 800 Gauss, And now this is true magnetic field strength in the model, in which we have a good linear response of the magnetograph. However, you'll notice above 800 Gauss, you begin to roll off. The data points are the model. The solid line is a fourth order curve fit. So somewhere around 1500 to 1600 Gauss, the magnetograph peaks, and thereafter we roll off. And this is the effect that you see in the umbra of any filter magnetograph, where you have decreasing response with increasing magnetic field strength. So we can model these things, but any calibration of a magnetogram really has to take place in a linear regime. And for that reason, we're only good to on the order of 800 to 1,000 Gauss with Stokes V magnetograms. So that's another thing to keep in mind. Any Stokes V magnetogram measurement over 1,000 Gauss is a difficult one. I've done work in comparing the ASP to the Soup magnetogram to try and calibrate the linear regime. This is an ASP map now. It's a spectrometer map of essentially the line of sight magnetic flux density. Bruce Leitz hates me to show this because this is really pretty lousy seeing at Sac Peak, but it was done specifically for a calibrational study, and it's all we had. So they got bad seeing that day. I got good seeing at La Palma. And that's what you want. So so what I've done now is take a pixel-to-pixel correlation of these two.
I bet he'll get his own back someday.
I think he will, yeah. And you can see that actually out to about somewhere beyond 1,000 Gauss in this case, we do maintain a linear response in the Soup magnetograph. However, there's starting to drop off. You can see it's very reliable out to 1,000 Gauss. And so this is what we've done now to sort of calibrate the Soup magnetogram, calibrating quotes, because with, as I've noted, with differing spatial resolutions, the filling factor comes in, and it's not possible for us to really deconvolve that. But we are seeing some hope that we can understand how filter magnetographs and spectropolarimeters, such as the ASP, can operate together in the same instrument as they will be in Solar B and understand the results in a cross-calibrational sort of way. This is just looking at the field measured within the sunspots of that previous magnetogram I showed you. And it's encouraging here that we get a nice fourth-order response, just like the model. The curve doesn't follow the same slope, but the fourth-order response is there. So our models of the Soup magnetogram don't quite fit in detail, but they are very accurate in terms of the overall behavior. So as a summary, Stokes filter magnetographs measure circular polarization density. This is related to the line of sight magnetic flux density, which is proportional to field strength only in the linear weak field regime. Calibration is non-trivial. Precision can be below 1%, but accuracy is no better than plus or minus 50%, I think has been mentioned a couple of times today. The unresolved nature of small-scale magnetic fields on the sun means that magnetogram response is very spatial resolution dependent via this filling factor parameter. I also mentioned that there are other algorithms in use besides Stokes V magnetograms. MDI magnetograms are not Stokes V magnetograms. They are magnetograms made by measuring the splitting of the distance between the Doppler LCP and RCP inferred line profiles. And you can back out the magnetic flux density that way, and these exhibit linearity, strong linearity, out to 2,000 Maxwells per square centimeter or Gauss. So that algorithm is a little bit more robust. This continues the summary. Obviously, if you're going to have things that are very highly spatial resolution dependent, flux accounting using filter magnetograms requires a lot of caution. Two examples, flux emergence in MDI magnetograms and La Palma magnetograms can appear unipolar, because the other component of the magnetic field that's emerging, div B does equal zero, can have a high angle of inclination of the magnetograph and fall below the noise level. So you'll look at this and you'll see a single polarity pop up. And you can be very fooled by that. A second effect has been seen by Lindsay and Hugh here. If you look at MDI magnetograms in a post-flare region, there's an imbalance of flux that has been essentially, what would you say, moved or swept out after the flare. And this was curious, and this can be understood because we've seen this also in relating Soup magnetograms to the ASP magnetograms. The smaller scale, the minority polarity in any active region tends to be more broken up. We've known this for a long time. The trailing sunspots are smaller, the trailing plage tends to be more broken up. So the minority polarity in any given region tends to be more broken up. and therefore spatially smaller, and therefore perhaps less detectable at any given spatial resolution, and certainly preferentially blended with the larger majority polarity structures. So in effect, you can get you've got a magnetogram which is not able to detect these. It's averaging over areas, and therefore not able to detect smaller minority polarity structures, and you get a polarity imbalance. That I think is just, I haven't seen that talked about before. It was just sort of discovered last year in the SOUP data, and then I talked to Lindsay and Hugh who had seen this. So I think it's a very real effect, and requires a lot of caution in working with these things. And so, it's okay. In your case, it's a very real effect in the SOUP data that we see that definitely, that we see blending. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, if the resolutions are comparable of the magnetograms, you don't see an imbalance. What you see this is when you look at a very high resolution magnetogram compared to a low resolution magnetogram, you see a polarity imbalance in the calibration. And if you blur it, yeah, I've done experiments with blurring SOUP magnetograms, and it comes right out. So we don't have to worry about it. Okay, so again, the best use of filter magnetograms is for high spatial and temporal resolution studies of magnetic field morphology and dynamics, except for the lack of polarity information and the fact that you're missing some of the field that isn't signatured by G-band bright points. You can also very easily study these sorts of problems using G-band or K-line radiative signatures. And I think I'll stop there.
Okay.
We were talking about that at the break. The problem with prominences is that they're very hard to see except in emission lines such as H alpha, which has an extremely complicated transfer function. I don't know anybody who's working on that problem directly right now, and I would think that that's something that the IR would maybe help you with, if that can. Yeah. So there's some Hanley effect stuff going on, I guess. Yeah. Yeah.
Fields are really there. But boy, they're hard to measure because the brightness up there in H alpha and the motion. In fact, I've been planning to do it next summer.
So you did polarimetry in H alpha and
we just used the video meter. There were some effects. We did the pairs too. But it's so difficult to take out the brightness showing.
And of course, I didn't touch on coronal magnetic fields, which is a whole other bag of worms.
Okay, one more.
Well, I think they're there. In that as well, it's a spatial resolution effect. You just typically, if you looked at a Kitt Peak magnetogram, for instance, you'd probably see the same thing. I just haven't looked at that. I've only been concentrating on the imaging instruments because that's typically what you use when you're doing flux accounting of large scale regions. And you need the instantaneous imaging capabilities for that. So. But it's spatial resolution, so it's got to be there. Yeah. It depends on the spatial resolution. Maybe there is some real effect, real flux imbalance effect. as well. I don't know.
Let's thank Tom again.